Here we go. So we have Mark McEachran here today. Thank you so much for the time. I'm really looking forward to this. We're all friends, so this is going to be a great discussion. Why don't we start off with your career path? Just talk about what it was like for you back in the day when you were a scrapper, you know?
Back in the scrappy old days, I have to go all the way back to college, actually. I was in the Illinois Institute of Technology way back. It started in 1993, and that number is significant. That year is significant. It's like year two of the web, and by 94, I had discovered the web and changed majors and decided that whatever I did, I was going to do on this new amazing interconnected thing. You could make pretty pictures and pretty pages and portray information and write code against it and all that stuff. It was just such a paradigm shift in my way of thinking about computers. And I fell in love. I fell in love with the internet, you know, with the internet of 1993. And I actually started my first company while I was still in school in 1996, I want to say, as a web design firm, you know, and it was just cranking out HTML for little companies and even big companies and big organizations. I think we did some work for Cancer Treatment Centers of America at some point, you know, two kids in a college room banging out code and little graphics for this organization we had no business dealing with, but it was the early days and there was no one else, you know, finding a proper web design firm back in 1996, 97 was impossible.
You know, yeah, I remember.
And, I found this guy, and people call him my bell cow, for a while. This guy, Frank, was in school with me and I don't even know how we met. But he was an entrepreneur and started companies, and I went to work for him at a couple of very scrappy companies. Ones you maybe probably never heard of. Well, actually, one you may have. Starting Point was one of the first search engines on the web, and I worked there in '97 with Frank, and you know, just working on ad serving things for Starting Point. And that was my first taste of advertising and marketing technology. And even back then it was, you know, it was interesting dealing with scale. Even back in the early days of the web, it was still an issue, you know. People were writing front-end services in Perl. And I bring that up in meetings these days and like, hey, I can do threaded Perl for you. You know, as my life as a product manager, that's my
sir, this is a Wendy's drive-thru. Sorry.
But I can really parse these. I can parse your orders. I can really parse them down and get them into the format. I can insert that into the database for you. No, for real. So yeah, it was the early days. In the early days of you know, keyword targeted advertising. At Starting Point. And eventually, you know, for me, it was a consulting job, and someone offered me some full-time work at some point. And I shifted over to work on some intranet thing for a telecommunications company that went belly up in glorious fashion in the late 90s. But then, you know, I was responsible for a whole project, not just a kind of a coder, but I had a whole project. I had to work with business stakeholders and it was all my own doing. Whatever my output was my own, and not a lot of oversight. It was sort of my first, you know, and I'm still in school at that point. my first job where nobody's kind of watching my work. They're just like, hey, yeah, build that thing. But turns out that might not have been the best management strategy. That company didn't do well in the long run. And then Frank showed up again in 98 and said, hey, I've got this other startup. I wanted to see if you're interested in coming over. So again, as an engineer, I went to work for another online marketing technology company. And it was the days of ad networks. And, you know, it was this little company at the time called AdNet Strategies. And we were just an ad network. We were going up against DoubleClick. We were fighting the good fight.
So wait a minute. Were you guys responsible for those toenail fungus ads and the belly fat things?
those actually came later. I think back then, belly fat. Was there belly fat back then? I'm not entirely sure. The things that I did for that company really, again, focused on data and moving data around opt-in marketing and
direct marketing.
And that was where I became a director, fresh out of college. Hey, you're a director. Hey, go hire a team. So I had a directorship, a team of seven engineers at one point at that company under me, all, you know, doing the business for customers like, you know, big companies, big media companies. We were developing software for big media companies and developing microsites and microsites. Ooh, that's a term you don't hear anymore.
And vertical portals.
Vertical portals.
Remember that.
nothing, absolutely nothing mobile. Everything desktop.
Yep.
And optimized for your 56K modem user who's dialed into AOL.
which they can never cancel. It's like Hotel California, right?
And you would decorate your house with the discs that they would send you. So I worked there for a few years, and it was great. It was the .com boom. It was such a wild, wild experience. It was, you know, the technology team would get flown out to California. I was living in Chicago at the time, and we'd get flown out to California and they would rent a limo and drive us around to different clubs and restaurants and bars and just make a mess. Like it's the things you would look at today and say, you know, it's not then anymore. That's the contrast. Like that was then. And now you're over here. We're a little more adult. We're going to go and do work and maybe we'll buy you dinner occasionally, but we're not renting limos and driving around in that excess. And of course that all had to come crashing down, right? In glorious fashion, company after company imploded. Our company imploded. We had people, you know, lawsuits and misdeeds and everything came to bear, and all the big mess, all the mess of the .com implosion, explosion, the .com bust. And then suddenly it's January of 2002, and I have no job, and there's no one hiring. And so there's no nothing. There's absolutely no investment in internet. And, you know, the 9/11 had happened, that previous September, and everything was pulled back. So it was the great withdrawal. There was no money to do much. And so I started, you know, what do you do as an entrepreneur? I started another company.
Yep.
So, you know, and it was a consulting company, and I had one, my partner, and I, started consulting, and we would find people we knew. My partner had also worked at L90. So we were all, familiar with each other. And so we knew our strengths and weaknesses, and he was the far, far better programmer than I was. So he loved the numbers. So we split tasks, right? He would do the accounting and the programming, and I would collect requirements. And I had never heard of what product management, that was not a term I was familiar with in my work history, but in essence, that's what I was doing. I was living the dream product management role, because I was also, you know, the CEO of the company, literally, not even figuratively. I know people throw that term around, that as a product manager, you're the CEO. That's not actually true, by the way. But in this case, it was for me, because I was the CEO. And, you know, for 2 years, we sort of scraped by with, you know, doing scripts here and data things there for people, mostly in DTC, direct to consumer areas. So it was kind of, you know, a little people like appending data for email blasting and things like that. It was not exactly what you would call elegant marketing, nor would it pass muster with any modern data regulations going around in California or Europe right now.
Right.
But it paid the bills. And at that point, you know, we needed to pay the bills. And eventually we started building out an email platform of our own, because that's what our customers were into. So it was like, well, okay, you respond to your customer need. And it didn't, you know, at that point, it didn't feel too terribly dirty. But as the years went on, I was like, oh, people really hate this stuff. You know, I'm sending out the belly fat. Then I'm sending out the acai berries. Right? that's where that comes in. They're like, oh, this is kind of dirty. But you know, the cash flow was working. It was definitely a cash flow business. We had no delusions of doing an IPO or selling to a big corporation. I mean, we were scrappy, very, very scrappy. But again, in that environment, in that affiliate marketing environment, it felt a little like the .com days. You know, people would still go out and do the parties and rent limos.
Because you were in ad tech, though, or media.
Probably. I, you know, I've been in it now.
It hasn't changed since.
Has it? No.
well, I mean, I don't participate, but yeah, there's still Kens and yachts and,
oh
yeah, it happens.
Okay. I've been working for larger companies. Maybe I've been shielded from it.
Well, we kind of age out too, you know?
Yeah, that's true too. And then eventually we're hosting the parties. You gotta get the younger generation. You're like, hey, let's go do fun things. Yay. Man, I'm tired.
That's what they call a Shanghai exit, you know. Suddenly you're just gone at night. You went that way, you know.
Yeah, but you pay the tab on your way out. I mean, you're very
elegant. Yeah, that's right.
Take care, you guys. I'll see you later. You're on your own from now on. I do recall doing that even in the last year. But, you know, I think as we were doing email, I think a couple things happened in the space toward the late aughts, toward the late 2000s. The Gmail platform became very, very popular. And suddenly your messages would no longer get delivered to a majority of your user base. So the company needed to pivot. I was not necessarily that interested in making a move there. And my wife was shifting her career focus, and we decided to move out to Los Angeles. So I sold the company to my partner and one of our big customers, and we moved to LA. And lo and behold, I went and had probably my shortest interview ever. I went and had margaritas out on the Santa Monica Pier with my good friend Frank, and he hired me on the spot. I was like, "Hey, I need to do this and that." And he's like, "Oh, I think we need a product manager." And I'm like, "No idea what that is, but let's go have a go at it." So became a product person at Rubicon in 2009, and almost immediately. Found a paradigm shift occurring in that space. They were an ad network optimization solution that helped publishers monetize their unsold inventory. So when a publisher has their own sales team, they go and sell, you know, the premium, what they call the premium. They sell to major buyers, major agencies. And then there's some leftover stuff. As a result of variability in inbound users, you know, fluctuations in what we call inventory, which is essentially a user visiting a page and seeing an ad. So that inventory would go up or down. And because of that variability, there was always some unsold inventory, and that's where these companies would come in and take care of it and help monetize that inventory for publishers. But the shift was happening where it was going from a tag-based approach where you would just, you know, serve the highest paying ad network tag to something called real-time bidding. And I remember the day I got a call from a friend of mine, Paul. And Paul was a guy that I met at L90, and he had this talent of knowing absolutely everyone in the industry. He was a sales guy, biz dev guy, but he was just so well connected. His mental Rolodex, amazing, because he knew CEOs down to support engineers and everyone in between. And he called me and he said, someone from this company, DataZoo, wants to talk to you about this thing, real-time bidding. And he didn't give me the details of what that was, but I recognized the name DataZoo as one of our ad network partners. And so I called, or I ended up talking to the CEO at DataZoo, and he was selling me on this real-time bidding, the shorthand RTB. And the next time we had an all product meeting, you know, we're all sitting in the room and says, anybody got new work that they want? And I raised my hand and I said, I think we should look at this real-time bidding thing. Seems like it might be something we want to be involved with. There's definitely a market shift going on. And that became one of the hallmarks of my career was bringing this real-time bidding solution, which involves similar to ad network optimization, where you're still dealing with the unsold inventory, but you're selling it one impression at a time to partners who are being presented the impression in real time rather than as a lump. I won't go too far into the technicalities, but the market paradigm was changing to that. And it took 2 years before that line of technology was responsible for 50% of the revenue at the company. And that was my baby. I brought this to the company and I'm going to bring it up. And it was kind of an amazing time for my career, because I had never had that experience and where it was this, I don't know, seismic shift, that I got to play a role.
Yeah. And for what it's worth for people listening, I mean, this kind of infrastructure scales to the size of the web really quickly without necessarily having to scale, your company and your team. It's ridiculous scale that a small amount of people end up managing pretty much. It's every single ad opportunity that's happening right now everywhere. And so when you're surfing the web and you're seeing ads, there's a multiplication effect to all of this RTB traffic, and it's a bunch of stuff, right? It's a big deal. It has a high impact. There's a lot of dollars changing hands, eyeballs for dollars, et cetera. So it can't be understated. This is like a fundamental piece of how all display and video ads and other kinds of ads are really showing up on your devices and on your Apple TVs and everything that everybody sees today.
Yeah. And it's interesting. The marketer, the advertiser has an opportunity to reach their audience every single time their audience shows up on the web. And that had never happened before. You could maybe get some centralization systems did that in the past, but this was democratized.
This was targeting the user, whereas before they might have at best targeted the content that they're looking at.
Yeah, yeah. And they might have figured out who the user was after the fact, after they had already purchased the inventory. This guy, well, we don't need to show him an ad anymore. Here's a house ad, or here's something that's not worth anything. Yeah. So the interesting side effect was that the relevance to the user, the advertising relevance to the user, increased dramatically. So you weren't seeing the blanket ad of, okay, you're on a travel site. Now you're seeing ads for, you know, maybe Hawaii or some tropical location. Instead, you might be on a travel site and you see the Hawaiian blouse you were looking at 5 minutes ago in the ad that you're seeing on the travel site. So you've got relevance and, you know, interest level through the roof, right? And that wasn't possible before, but now it's like we've reached the uncanny valley of programmatic advertising, because people are getting a little freaked out that blouse or that pair of shoes is showing up everywhere because they looked at it once, right? And they're like, hey, there's got to be a lot of data moving around about me if you're able to target this discreetly.
And worse off, people who don't do the suppression targeting, if you buy the damn thing and it's still following you around, you know,
yeah,
it's I already have you. You know?
there's a reason for that. It's a little bit of work to set up, and the amount of dollars wasted isn't worth setting it up.
Moot. I know.
so you get to keep seeing those. But you know, the impact on your brand is making some people take notice.
Yep.
So yeah, I got to watch it, you know, the rise and fall, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to that industry, but for me, you know, I went from, hey, I'm a product manager, starting out in, and I'm actually writing a little bit of code that I'm responsible for. And now I'm responsible for the work product of, you know, a team of six engineers. By the end of the run on RTB, I had 100 engineers working on product that I had been responsible for, individually responsible for. I wasn't even in charge of the team. RTB was I was the RTB guy, and it was all me. And you know, my head's exploding. I'm staying at work until 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night. And honestly, you know, it took a toll. And that kind of thing takes a toll in places you don't expect it. It definitely took a toll on my marriage. You know, riding that wave, being under that much pressure of this giant thing. Definitely had a major impact, and there was a bit of a come to Jesus moment between me and my wife, you know, around work, around our relationship, and there was a lot of stress at home, and to be honest, I was, you know, 2-3 drinks every night to sort of as a coping mechanism. Not a great thing to do, and definitely something you keep an eye on further down the road. But it was not great. Toward the end, personally, even though I was riding high from a career standpoint, there are costs to victories sometimes.
Yeah, and, I can relate.
Yeah. And, you know, afterward, I stayed with the company for quite a long time, maybe too long. I was there, I mean, on and off 8 years, and eventually I got into, you know, part of the rebuilding of my relationships at home, was to shift focus again and move back to Chicago. And I took the job with me, but definitely dialed down on what I was doing. I, you know, that managed to get a team built out to handle different aspects of that, product, and, took a much, much reduced role in the scope of the company, to such a degree where the company said, look, you're not doing as much. Why don't you become a consultant and we'll just keep you on half time? Cause there are things that, you know, when you build out something like that, there are always rough edges that, you know, maybe only you understand. And so they need to keep you on. And I think everybody who's been in a central role in a company like that, I think they've all got their, yeah, I was full time and then I was a consultant and I stayed a consultant for a number of years, you know, because you can stay on, you know, filling that one gap that was not easy to fill otherwise.
Yep. So that mind share, some of that tribal knowledge that you're seeing in Mississippi still handed down. Yep.
Yeah. You know, and I bounced around as a consultant. I did work here and there, and I took a, you know, I did a little teaching at a local organization in Chicago that was sort of entrepreneurial in nature. I was a senior director at another company that I didn't really take that too far. There was no scale. You know, and that's the other thing. You come out of a big company and then you start working for a small company that's not necessarily a startup, And you know, when you're at the big company, you have all this leverage, you know, because Rubicon had become, you know, I started as an employee 101 or 109 or whatever, and then it grew to like 700 people. So right, now it's a big company. So no longer startup, you're big company. You've seen the full gamut of things that change. You know, from, hey, we don't have a 401k. Hey, we've got excellent 401k. Hey, we don't have dental, but now, you know, everything's covered, you know, all that kind of stuff. and so, you know, eventually I came back and forth. I went back to Rubicon again, as a vice president. And that's one of the interesting things. You sometimes have to walk away and come back, to get the promotion you want.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot in this whole series of people who leave and then come back once the company's grown more.
Yeah, and I left. I don't even know if I was a director when I left. I think I was just a regular old product manager. Came back as a vice president, and it's interesting. I didn't do that. You know, on one part, like that could feed the ego. But my rationale for it, or at least I told myself my rationale for wanting that role, was that this was a company that was in an acquiring phase. And if I was going to come back, I didn't want to have that lack of authority that could come with someone who came in from an acquisition who came in with a VP or an SVP title. I didn't want to have them come in and they don't know me from Adam. You know, they're like, who is this PM you've got here that making a stink because I want to do X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, well, actually, because you don't have to tell them the whole history. You can be like, well, but you know, I'm vice president just like you are, and let's have a conversation that's not you trying to step on me because of a title.
That's right. Yeah.
And certainly, you know, my bell cow Frank was never big on titles, but titles, I don't know, they tell a short version of a story. Maybe they tell a short version of why you have authority. I'm not entirely sure what they do in the social setting. I do know, you know, you need them for hierarchy, and you need them for establishing, I guess, responsibility to say, you know, this person is responsible enough to go out and buy people dinner and then pay the bill and then take care of their expense report. And I'm not gonna, you know, they get to be in charge. Like, well, okay, I'll be in charge. And yeah, so yeah. And then you get to the modern, I guess the modern era, the last 4 or 5 years, again, it's been a big company story. I haven't been at a small startup. You know, I spent some time at a Japanese company, building out, I guess I would say I built my second SSP, in collaboration with a team in Japan and a team in the US. And that was a big learning experience, because not only are you at a big company, this is a massive company, and you have massive cultural differences. So just in the way you do things, and there's, you know, we call them soft skills, but you recognize when others don't have them, and you have to adapt. Mm-hmm. So you've got leaders that are just sort of lacking in soft skills, or you know, maybe they emphasize their technical skills instead of soft skills. And certainly in technology, you get a lot of folks who are incredibly strong in their technology skills and have not had need or desire to develop the more social skills that help you get along in the workplace. And working with, you know, across cultures and across technologies, that was definitely highlighted in the last few years. Mm-hmm. that difference, that distinction. And it's something, you know, it's now something that I look at and I say, you know, of all the technology things, I mean, technology is my background. I can do it in my sleep. I think I can say, okay, well, the right solution here is XYZ. We either build it, we rent it, or we buy it. And let's look at the numbers, yada, yada. But then relaying that information and selling that idea and having an opinion about it and getting people on board about why your opinion matters and why that's important. That's something that you don't go to school for necessarily. It's something you pick up along the way.
Yeah.
And And I think in technology, it's important to pay attention to that. And it's important to know, in as much as I want to know which languages you know, or how deep you go in a key value store. I also want to know where your soft skills lie, where your social skills lie. That's as important when you're building out a team or when you have team members. You need a full spectrum of people that vary, you know. And sometimes you find one of those that, you know, my tech skills have definitely softened. So
you need all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you find it within the people, and sometimes you really need to grow it. And that's kind of a good segue point into the next piece of this discussion, which is, you know, you just gave a lot of great examples of where you came from, where you hopped to, the kinds of roles, the different focuses or whatever, foci or whatever. And, you know, but then, you know, once you took control of these tech orgs, probably starting small with your 7-person team, like, what kind of things were you working on to ensure that beyond just the individual contributor being challenged, like, right, like the whole team's got a challenge, they've got a tough deadline, they got a tough thing, and they've bought into doing something in a time frame. That's challenging in and of itself. The work should be challenging, but how do you go even outside of that and make sure every individual contributor has challenges for their own professional growth at that small team level starting out, and then we'll go bigger too?
Yeah. And that's, it's interesting you bring that up. Mentoring has been very much on my mind, and I've seen sort of a lack, a striking lack in mentoring and mentorship among my peer group as I've been at these big companies. It's been, in a lot of cases, I've been terribly disappointed.
Yeah, it gets thrown out the door because if there's deadlines and high stakes environments, that's the first thing to get cut. That's why I ask, you know, and it's why some people didn't respond to the outreach to talk about this, because some companies don't put this as much forefront as others. And it's not just companies, it's individuals too. But
go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. And for me, I am, when I come into an organization, I am not as concerned about, can I go up and make mentorship an organization-wide thing? Can I come at it from the outside? My approach is always, I will take it upon myself to mentor my team and mentor those around me and try to present that whenever possible. Try to present the mentorship as like, here, this is, you know, the results. This is this, you can't go in, hey, as a result of my mentorship, so-and-so is now sending out a weekly report and corresponding with his business stakeholders. You know, nobody says that's ridiculous.
Right.
But you do want it known that, like, look, I've taken everybody on my team under my wing, and I'm having one-on-ones with them, and I'm figuring out, you know, at what, you know, which quadrant in the problem solving area are they in with the particular set of problems that they have or the particular set of challenges that they're trying to solve for. And, you know, there's been training, right? I've gone through training. The last company went through training on mentorship and finding out where your team members are. And it's been really good. I gotta say, I praise that company a lot. It was Rakuten. And you know, praise it a lot for pushing the mentorship as a, like, here, let's teach our leaders how to be mentors. But I don't know if that sticks with everyone. I don't know if everybody's like, I don't know if they see the benefits. Like,
yeah. So I think, yeah, go ahead. Sorry. Well, I was going to say, I think it does show up, right? It shows up in other places. It shows up, number one, in your retention rate. So how long are people staying on your team? Number one, it shows up in other places if you factor this into your candidate experience, because any good candidate hopefully is interviewing you and your company as much as you're interviewing them. And the good ones will peel the layers back and ask, like, what's in it for me? You know, and if you tell them you have growth tactics and stuff, they'll say, well, show me. And if you could even freely talk about employees off the top of your head that are excelling in these programs and in this environment, it could actually show up in how you both attract and then retain these individuals and so forth.
Yeah, maybe that's where I stop short of figuring out the metrics. I think you know, the key performance indicators are very, very hard to sort through, right? You know, you mentor your team and you get good performance out of them. But is it the mentorship program? Is it that you're really good at it? Because, you know, then there are other teams in the same organization that went through the same training that are floundering, and their team members will come to me and say, I wish I were you're on your team, because you guys get the projects that really succeed. And I'm like, well, the reason we get those, I can't even tell you.
I would say, at least in the scenario where we're at right here, you're talking about managing individual contributors.
Yeah.
And doing this under your own compunction.
Yeah.
And that kind of is the segue into the next part, which is that you have a bigger org. How do you ensure it still happens? So it sounds like you might have been in an environment where your own manager didn't have this on their list. It wasn't an imperative of their own, where they're overseeing managers that also ensure that there's a formal process for growth management.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, fair statement.
Well, I wouldn't throw my manager under the bus. It was a big organization. It was I'll hear about it on the next fishing trip. No, but it wasn't like it was a different. There was all these different organizations, right? And they're different leaderships and different people picked out on those teams, and it was a lateral approach. The mentorship training was done laterally outside of any sort of team hierarchy. It was all, all the vice presidents and director level people get this training across the company.
Yeah.
So, and you can either latch onto that or not. And I think some folks like me, you know, were already going to latch onto that, but then others were potentially going to ignore it or just, you know, phone in the training attendance and go back to whatever it is that they were doing that maybe may or may not have brought them success in the past.
Right. And that's a key indicator, or that shows up when you're screening talent and you're hiring people. Let's say that person you just said was at another company. Sometimes you find people who leave those managers because they don't like them, or they leave their team, and then they show up back on the market. When you ask them, like, why are you in the market? They'll say, like, well, I was just kind of on a loop in my old org. I was challenged and it was cool, but there wasn't enough engagement from my own management to make me want to stay there. I couldn't see where I was going next. They couldn't tell me which hill I was going to tackle personally, et cetera. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, so that shows up in people that leave and then show up elsewhere, you know?
Would that be the example? I mean, it sounds like the example of people don't leave bad jobs, they leave bad managers.
Yeah. And one of the interviews I just got off before we started this one, the individual was talking about how they sort of did a retrospective on a good employee that decided to leave suddenly. And we were talking about there should be no surprises, right? If you're one-on-one-ing enough with that individual, but also their team. And if there's a skip level one-on-one beyond the manager of that team to that individual every so often, there should be enough indicators where you could either put them on a PIP if they're not doing well, or vice versa, maybe even identify the manager's not doing well and put them on a PIP, et cetera. And all the while you're not burning someone out so much because stuff's being taken care of. It doesn't fester forever. It's not a surprise, basically.
Right. No, you're right. Yeah. It shouldn't be a surprise when somebody leaves, unless they get the amazing opportunity or they had a secret startup they were working on.
I may which have bravo to them. Those
are the best ones, though. Those are the fairy tale stories. Like, look at how talented this guy is. He was working his job, and at night he was, you know, doing this other thing and making, you know, setting himself up for the next thing.
I've left a couple companies to start companies, and it's the CEOs I stay tightest with, actually, and they have this curiosity, like, well, how are you doing? You know, like, in a way, I don't want to use the vampire analogy, but they sort of help make you at some level along the way. Mm. So they want to see you succeed and make others, right? If they're a good CEO or whatever. So yeah, those have been the most amicable separations, because it's like, it's not you, it's me. Like, I just want way more. And it's not like you chose their competitor to go work for or something like that, right? It's the best way to leave, in my opinion.
Yeah, so long as you're not building the competitor.
No, totally.
You're like running off with three engineers, like, yeah, you're going to be in your space in a year's time. Just to make sure that we don't violate any IP agreements.
Oh, man. Never done that.
No. Well, I mean, it's kind of a terrible thing to do, and you certainly make a name for yourself. It's surprising how small the industry is, even though it's huge, right?
Yeah.
I'm in the advertising technology, and, you know, it's like at this point, it's like we're all old friends. All these guys in these companies, we're all like, oh, hey, yeah, I know so-and-so over that company. He started that 3 or 5 years ago, and he's doing well. And I know Dave from, you know, random consulting gig I did between my Rubicon days.
Yeah, no, I mean, we go way back probably almost 10 years at this point. And
yeah,
it's probably because the curse of the ad tech that we both have, you know?
Right. It's like, I'm still invited to go from time to time, go talk about how your ad gets on the web and how that ad got in front of you, which is good fun. I do this whiteboard session where I take people through like, okay, you're a guy on the internet and here's what happens. And like take them from like you open the web page, all the little things that go on around that loading of that web page, all the behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
How many computers there's like, well, honestly, there's about 200 machines deciding what ad to show you
right
in that moment.
Yep. Yep. And all of this magic happens in less than about 100 milliseconds or more before you can blink, you know.
It is mind boggling, but here we are.
Yeah, with all this talk of, you know, various size teams and so forth, and we had been spending a good amount of time just at that line manager level where you're dealing with ICs and stuff. You know, what do you do with some of these best folks you have? And they get stuck in a rut, right? They're doing awesome work, but you got to change it up. So, you know, what are some of the options, or what are some of the ways you've helped people out of the ruts?
Well, it depends on their which direction they want to go. Do they want to continue in IC or do they want to go management track? In my space, in product management space, most of the time folks want to go, you know, they want to become a manager of a team. And that's, you know, many of them were doing engineering work before and they chose product management because there was that opportunity, or it's more interactive with people, right? Most of the time they want to have a team. And if that is the case, I work to start building that for them, and to the point where I will make an attempt at least to step out of the way and actually let them take charge of the product that I'm responsible for. And sometimes it's really hard, and sometimes it's a career move that requires you to go find work other places. But you know, if you got there, you know, I got there, I can go find a job if I wanted to bequeath that. Or, I mean, in all honesty, you say, go, if there is no space, if there is no room, if you're connected enough in the industry, and generally you and your subordinates are in the same industry, maybe you help them out on the sly, go find another gig.
Yeah.
That is that one. You know, and that's not popular with, you know, your current employer would not like to hear that.
Yeah.
But if you've got an open headcount and you can fill the role and you know the job and you do it right and you've got time to transition that role to someone else who can handle it, it's not a bad way to go.
That's a win-win, because then that person becomes an ambassador, if not for you, for your company too, even though they're leaving. Yeah. And you know, I used to tell people, especially in one-on-ones, this is more of a personal thing, but you know, I interviewed about 120 times in 10 years. So about once a month, all the time. It's my guilty pleasure to just go interview companies, is the way I looked at it. Not that I ever needed a job, but it was like, as soon as I decided I wanted to transition, I didn't use recruiters. I already had the canvas and the landscape, knew where I was going to go next. Sometimes on the come, you know, like there's already an open door somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I would challenge people. Well, not challenge, even if they weren't stuck in the rut, I would tell people, you should go interview somewhere else. Like, take a day off, just go interview. You don't have to tell us, just take a sick day or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it actually is good for you because it sets perspective, because people will leave and they have grass is greener syndrome, and then they come back in 6 months or a year. So there's that, right? And it could be because the company grew and whatever. But also, it's great to see like what you've already got. You don't know what you got till it's gone.
Yeah.
And actually, if you find that what you got here is not what you like, you're going to find it out sooner too. And so there's really no downside to me to people mixing up and talking. That's something similar. Even though I was a co-founder, that probably my partner would have retched at or whatever. You know, it's like, don't tell them to go. You know how hard it is to get people in the door. Mm-hmm. But nobody ever told that to left, actually. I mean, no, people come and go, but they didn't leave on the basis of, you know, that they weren't happy with us. It was something else with them and their growth. Maybe their wife moved back east to get into grad school and they had to go. There's all kinds of life situations, right? But I always encourage people to interview anywhere else.
Right.
Yeah, anyhow.
It is an interesting tactic, or is that a strategy?
I don't know. It's like basically like calling, not a calling a bluff, but it's like, it is kind of crazy points. It's like, do it, go interview somewhere else. You know, it's, but yeah, I mean, you might lose good people that way too. Cause you're like, oh, I guess I'm a jerk, you know, but no, but really it's, I think if you're able to say that with a straight face, you probably have enough there that, you know, people want to stay, hopefully.
Hopefully. And if they come back and say, well, they have this and this that we don't have, or, you know, if there's some cultural thing, you know, if they do come back with some feedback, because it's another perspective, right? They're going out and gaining more perspective. They're going to bring that back and potentially, and in fact, very likely enhance the culture at your company with whatever they learn from the interview process.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So it could be an ultimate win either way. And at the end of the day, you know, if they go, you backfill and figure it out. It's all business, right? You know, we're in this world where we're beholden to the bottom line of the company, but let's not forget we're humans. Let's not forget the human factor that, you know, we want to have a good experience at work. And if they're not having that at your workplace, then they need to go find a place that does make them happy.
Yeah, good way to look at it.
Yeah, because you know, if they're not happy at your company, they're not going to be they're not going to be positive about it.
Nice. Yeah, can you think of any folks along the way that just were outstanding in their own path? Like they went through their own arc a lot quicker than the mean or the average or whatever. Well, any high-performing individuals that you saw go through your org?
My first bell cow, Frank, he was an entrepreneur from the very beginning and a .com guy. And even beyond that, he had this nature about him to be hyper-focused on what he was trying to achieve. And if that meant he had to go connect with a bunch of strangers to make it happen, he did. And that may sound weird. You know, what do you mean you're afraid to talk to people? A lot of us are, you know, a lot of us are afraid of that introduction. And I certainly, you know, I went and talked to a VC guy, a couple of them actually in my in-between days where I was just kind of doing my own thing. And I had no idea what to say to them. Like I am not in this world. I don't know anybody in this world. Let me go have a chat. Nope. No idea what to say to you. And that tells me like, well, that's
nice glasses and Patagonia vest jacket.
I don't have a deck for you. I don't know what I'm doing. Okay. Well, see you later. And that's what I got. Oh, well, okay. I got to go. You know, these guys are like, I don't have any time for people that don't know what they're doing. You know, Frank was, he was amazing at this. And I always thought that was kind of an incredible strength. And he built three companies or four companies or five companies, or I think I worked for five of his companies and took two or three of them public, you know, and like, this is a guy I went to school with. I'm like, oh, cow, amazing. So he was definitely one. And that's why he was that guy I would go work for again and again.
Yeah.
And you know, we were probably better friends in the early days, and in the later days, didn't have a falling out, but just didn't really connect much anymore. But I just watching that progression of him moving again and again to do business after business after business and something that interested him was really just kind of something I was drawn to. And then the other guy who, and he, this one is actually still a very good friend of mine, Neil. He is, I think I may have introduced him to you at some point. I don't know. But he has become a very good friend. He and I both grew up out in you know, rural areas of the world, and fishing and chopping wood and being outdoorsy are things that come very natural to both of us. But his brilliance and focus also, again, it's driven him in a couple of different ways. He's a little bit contrasting with Frank in that, you know, he'll retain a close group of people around him that he has known forever, people that go back 20, 30 years. And really, he will pull them together, not just for work, but for fun. He'll be like, we're all going fishing. We're all going skiing. Everybody's collected. We're going to, but he's got that, you know, also an entrepreneur. He started one or two companies and sold one. That's how I met him, sold one to the company I was working for. But then he wouldn't go and strive, for that promotion, but he would drive so hard at the things he was trying to achieve that it just became a natural thing to be like, this is the guy we want to lead our technology.
Yeah. Good promotions are the ones that by the time you get the title, you've already been doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
For a while, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's Neil. And yeah, again, he's also a very good friend. So that's a plus. And so we call each other on the weekends and bounce things back and forth. You know, and of course we're both in the same industry, so it's all good fun. We have very, very what we call high bandwidth conversations.
Absolutely. When I've chatted with them, I rarely chat with people that I literally have to work really, really hard to keep up in the conversation. And Neil's definitely one of them. And he's a fast reader, so when we're talking deep on stuff, he mm-hmm. just gets it. So yeah, one of those people, it's like a Vulcan mind melt kind of conversation.
You know? Oh, and to watch him walk in a room and plug in to the conversation, you know, it's of course a technical conversation and the nuances of the conversation, and then pull out his book of math and be like, well, that's this is the AI that we need to build in order to solve this problem. You know, within 5 minutes of walking into a room where we're already deep in the conversation, he plugs into everybody. He's like,
yeah,
he jacks into the matrix of the room.
That's cool. Good way to put it.
Yeah. I know kung fu.
Right. Oh my God, Neil's fighting Morpheus, you know. Okay. All right. So with that, let's turn into the home stretch here. We're going to talk about wild cards, my favorite part of this discussion, which is just any interesting story in terms of job interviews, either from the hiring side of the table or from the candidate side of the table. I want to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly. Mostly the ugly.
Mostly the ugly. Shoot. I had a moment at one of my jobs where I had been promised, and I asked them to put it in writing too. I'd been promised a raise. I had this revolving door of bosses. And a new boss would come in every 6 months, and getting a raise in that environment is ridiculous because the new guy's like, well, I'm not going to make any changes yet. Give me 6 months and boom, he's gone. Right. And then the next guy, well, give me 6 months. I'm not going to make any changes yet. I'm just so frustrating. So I had one of them. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to have to write this down, you know, in January 1st, here's the raise. And he wrote it down. Didn't sign it, but he wrote it down, which apparently was enough. But he was gone. Poof, right? He left. But I had this document. I was like, he wrote this down. He was going to give me a raise and a promotion.
Right.
And couldn't, you know, and I was like, okay, well, I got to walk. I got to be ready to walk. So I went and I interviewed at LinkedIn. And I'm like, I built RTB at this company, and I should be a shoo-in. They have an advertising product manager role. And I'm like, that's, of course they'd hire me. They're display advertising. I know everything about the industry right now. And so I went, I flew up to Santa. Well, actually before I did that, my new boss said, oh, I see this document. We're going to take care of you. And I go, perfect. And he did. He pushed through the raise. I had the raise. And I'm like, well, look, I had this interview with LinkedIn. And I like, to your point, I was like, I'm kind of curious what's going on up there. And he said, go. Let me know how it goes. Same way you would have done, Dave.
Yeah.
And so I went up to LinkedIn and I had the interview. I thought it was going great. You know, talked about RTB, talked about my history, looked at the company, looked at the product they were trying to build, yada, yada. I'm like, this is great. And I met everybody and everybody liked me and I liked everybody and went out and came back home with a good feeling. And I'm like, I'm totally going to get that job. And I went and told my boss, I'm like, hey, it was really great. And, you know, I'm pretty sure they're going to offer me the job, but I'm not going to take it because, you know, we took care of things here. And then what happened?
You didn't get an offer.
I didn't get an offer, Dave. They said, no. They said, you don't have enough B2C experience. Oh,
you're like, damn it, I've got people skills.
Do have people skills.
Oh man. So well, there you go. That's hence why they're not calling you on your bluff, but it's like, do it. Go look. Do go it. See what the real job market will bear for you.
Go watch them turn you down. Oh no, you're kidding me. I was like, this was the job. I was like, I was gonna get that. But you know, this was pre-Microsoft acquisition, and I don't know that the culture has changed there. They really seem to have stuck to it from the outside perspective. So, you know, it was really, really like the culture that they presented over there. So, So if you're listening out there, LinkedIn, good job.
Although, good job missed, for not choosing me.
You missed an opportunity, but good job.
Right. Well, it changes over time. I remember how hard back in the day in my early career, I was trying to get Google's attention and they only hired like elites and PhDs and stuff.
Yeah.
And then it became an inflection point where they wouldn't stop bothering me. And then they finally went away because I think their ATS and the long tail memory of who they reach out to eventually catches up to you. And then they stop talking to you, you know, you've said no 9 times, so it's a no, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, or they data mine your Gmail and other things to figure out if they really want you. I think some of that do, you know.
They've never called.
Oh.
And if they, I can't blame them. I mean, the things that go through my Gmail account, I'd be like, no, not that guy. No, that's weird.
Maybe a little karma from those emails.
Maybe. Maybe they're like, you know. Yeah, this guy's got some dirty underbelly.
You're responsible for 500 billion spam messages, my friend.
We built some really good software. I think that number's probably pretty close.
So most of my life's been white hat botting. So I'm up around 500 billion web page requests, I think, something like that.
Oh,
it might be low actually. So when they say like half the web's bots, I'm like, are you sure it's only half? You know?
Do you self-identify or do you use a user agent that masks you?
A lot of it was at Crux. I helped pretty much build the data sentry product there, which basically inspected display ad tags and unpack them and look at the Usher attribution, see the tags that bring in the tags that bring in the tags that drop the pixels that do the things. And we'd put it into an abstract syntax tree back into like a tree, basically a visual tree. And, so the problem with that is you can't identify because you have to look real because you have to have ads loading inside in order to inspect them.
Yep.
But we gave those numbers back to the publishers so they'd know how to minus it out and get their true skew. But it wasn't that much traffic. It was actually statistically insignificant traffic at that.
Well, yeah, but then there's 500 guys like you doing that.
Yeah. No, I know.
And then it becomes statistically significant.
No, but yeah, but our intention wasn't to inflate ad revenues. It was to see who in their supply chain should be cut out. It was literally identifying the bad tags that they needed to mix.
You were doing supply path optimization before that became an acronym.
Yeah, and data leakage detection at that too.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of what they called it.
But are the listeners going to get all this? This is some pretty inside baseball.
Yeah, this is kind of a lot of ad tech stuff, but okay, let's reel it in. Either maybe a recruiter horror story or another interview
anecdote. Another interview anecdote. I should have done my homework on this one.
You're fired. Oh, wait. You don't get the job. No, I'm kidding.
Right. Well, I mean,
I'm kidding.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, I was laid off twice and I went back to that same company.
Man, you're a glutton for punishment.
I am. I liked it. I think it was a nice gig. I had good memories. I liked the people. You know, that's what always brings you back is the people more than anything else, I think. Interviews that went horribly, horribly wrong. I think I've been spared many of those. In product, the joke is if you're a vice president of product, or if you're a vice president without any direct reports, you might be in product. Which is not, I mean, that's not untrue. There's a lot of that out there. And it's there, it comes with a, you know, as an IC, it's really hard to get a VP title and to get, you know, but you're in charge. You don't have direct reports. You have a lot of engineers that sort of laterally report to you.
Right.
Project management people that laterally report to you. So I end up interviewing a lot of engineers, and that's where, you know, some of those soft skills come into play, where you're like trying to figure out their social weaknesses. And, you know, because I'm not as interested in the technology.
Yeah, your chops, right? You want to see
Are you gonna be a good team member? Are you gonna fit with our team, or are you, you know, do you have too many sharp edges? Are you gonna grind on them?
Yeah, I mean, the way I summarize that question at the bar when I'm meeting another technology leader or whatever, it's like, how do you? There's like a lot of personality types. I won't go into them all, but one of them is the intelligent asshole. It's someone who's got all the chops, and it's like actually somewhat easy to hire them if you're not careful enough. And then within their first 2 weeks, they're a disaster. They're passive aggressive. They're doing weird stuff with team members. They're lone wolves and they're really hard to get along with, but their output's amazing. Right. And so the question I've given to folks is like, how do you find this personality type in the interviewing process? And how do you really probe for those soft skills? Like I literally call it poking with a stick, right? It could be that they're up there at the whiteboard, not whiteboarding code, mind you, but they're whiteboarding something else in the way that they'd be working with you. And that people will put a lot of undue pressure to have them stop mid-sentence or justify something or explain. And that's one way. There's a lot of ways, but that's one of my fun wild cards is how do you find folks? I mean, granted, the cliche cultural fit is poor. There's a lot of reasons, but there's also people that you kind of probably don't want on your team, actually. How do you find them?
It's a tough question. I wonder, you know, and this is obviously bringing that to the forefront of my mind. Do you go in there and try to push the buttons?
Yes, I do. Well, we do.
Hey, look, I'm gonna push. I'm gonna find your buttons. I'm gonna press them, and I'm gonna see how long it takes for you to get mad.
No, we don't even say that though. We just do it.
You don't go in saying that.
No,
because then they're gonna be ready for you. You know, it's like. It's like trying to
fight or flight.
It's getting like I'm trying to tickle my own foot. Well, I know it's me.
No, yeah, I know.
But do you go in there and say I'm gonna be a complete jerk, or at least for a good 10 minutes I'm gonna be a jerk and.
There's a boundary there. It's like basically seeking clarification. It's like a comms strategy where. You're like Columbo. You're like, wait, slow this down for me. Explain this. You know, you can be politely persistent.
Yeah.
Or you could be a jerk. You're right. But you definitely don't want to be the jerk to show them that this is how bad it's going to be to work here every day too. You know,
you got me to deal with every morning.
Yeah. So that's not the intention. I mean, there's a couple other personality types. You have the, architectural astronaut who wants to convert everything to closure because it's cool and, you know, et cetera. Those can be coached. You can bring them down to earth usually.
Sure.
But the intelligent asshole usually cannot be coached because it's something in the affective. It's something in the way that they behave, and it's really hard to change behaviors, especially in presumably grown-ups, you know.
Right. And I think you have to go outside of the work environment, and they have to really want to change. you know, they have to do some self-learning, some self-education, and find something out there that can help them, right? Help them. Because really it's what are they? The workability, right? You gotta make it work. And sometimes, you can't make it work for everybody. If that, because you can't, maybe you can deal with that guy. But the people with the lesser soft skills, the lesser social skills, the lesser talent in that area, they don't have to be subjected to that, right? You can't say, hey, you gotta work with this jerk 5 days a week and then go home and be happy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, definitely in an earlier stage company, like when there's like four cells in the organism, four people,
it's easy, right?
There can be raw people, and it's like, you know each other enough. You bust each other's onions chops. Sometimes or whatever. And yeah, you bust each other's chops, and it's just kind of part of it, but that doesn't scale one bit. And in fact, it could be really toxic really quick early on, but actually sometimes it produces the kind of results too. Some people, when you get into the affective domain, that's where they become hyperproductive too. And some people get themselves into that through their own disciplines and stuff, a lot of different programs to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the building tech, right? That's the easy part.
Yeah. It's the people, right? The
people is the hard part, and it's the part that you need to work on the most.
Absolutely. Well, with that, Mark, I really want to thank you for your time today. This has been a great discussion. I think we've touched on a lot of great topics, a lot of funny topics, a lot of old school stuff and back in the day, and a bunch of cryptic RTB ad tech crap that nobody understands. And maybe they understand less about it now that we've been talking about it. So thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to the next time we can have a pint and go even deeper into some of this stuff.
Thanks, Dave. It's been great fun.